Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, Seneca listeners. Today, we're very proud to present a new podcast in the Seneca Network on SubChina. It's called New Voices, and it's a show all about women in China with a focus on women in the world of letters. It's hosted by Alice Xin Liu, a translator originally from Beijing, but who grew up in the UK before coming back to Beijing. And by Joanna Chu, a Hong Kong-Canadian journalist who you've heard on Seneca a couple of times in the last year or so. Today's show features Yuan Yang, a correspondent for the Financial Times in Beijing. We hope that you enjoy it and that it makes you think and that you will subscribe and keep an ear out in coming weeks as we introduce more great podcasts about various facets of China. Now please enjoy.
Hello, welcome to the second episode of the New Voices podcast. This is Alice, recording from Beijing, and Joanna is in Vancouver. Say hi, Joanna.
Hey, Alice. Nice to see you on Skype.
Yeah, it's great to see you. What have you been up to?
I've been setting up my house in Canada and, you know, staying engaged in China things from afar.
You moved there, right, recently from Beijing?
Yeah, I moved here. Yeah, I've been in Greater China for 7 years, so it's nice to go back home and kind of settle down a bit and kind of balance work and life better.
Yeah, that sounds really good. We miss you a lot from over here. So tell me about self-care. What have you been doing today?
Yeah, so we're going to start every podcast with self-care because New Voices, it seems like we do so much, but we want to make sure that all our members and volunteers are taking care of themselves. So what I'm doing for self-care today, I went paddleboarding. I got a secondhand paddleboard and I did a workout on the lake and it was amazing. How about you, Alice?
Today I spent a couple of hours just relaxing because yesterday was the last day of my yoga teacher training in Beijing, which I chose to do 20 days of really intensive teacher training. I feel like self-care is important in the sense that I don't always have to be pushing myself in terms of my career or in terms of other ambitions. So I like to do things that are really challenging, but not like what we're going to discuss today.
Yeah, so it's important, especially because what we talk about on the podcast and other forums can be quite overwhelming and depressing. Like me too, it's people speaking out around the world about sexual harassment and power dynamics. So today I'll just start with talking about my earlier reporting on how Me Too started in China. It started last October, as you know, with the hashtag going viral on Twitter and everyone sharing their stories and Harvey Weinstein and all the stories around that. And people, us in China, were looking around and seeing when is this going to pick up in China or will it ever pick up in China given, you know, so many taboos in society here and the government online censorship. So nothing really happened for months in China except New Year's Day earlier this year. A former PhD student, Luo Xixi, she lives in the West Coast, U.S. now, but she posted her story on Weibo on January 1st, where she talked about how her former PhD supervisor lured her to a house under the pretense of asking for help watering plants and tried to rape her. And her story, she told it in detail, really kicked off the Me Too movement in China. But at first, I actually spoke with her and she was so surprised at how powerful it was and how many people spoke up afterwards. Students and professors, they signed petitions like all over the country. And, you know, in China, we always say collective action is unusual as far as on this large scale all over the country. But still, Me Too, in the first few months of the year, it only focused on universities mostly and professors getting outed as having harassed students. I talked to a master's student in Qingdao, and she was the first person known to sue police for inaction on her rape case. She said police did not take her seriously, and she actually was able to file her lawsuit in court. But the way she was taking action, she still felt really isolated because it hadn't spread in China beyond universities. But in the past few weeks, we've seen this changing. So what have you noticed, Alice, in the news in China?
Well, I think, so first of all, I have been out of it for so long with yoga teacher training. But I think the last 2 weeks has just really, really, really skyrocketed in terms of the number of stories that have come out about Me Too in China. It's sort of a pivotal moment because it's also happening right now. We will get into this with our guest Yuan, so I will just introduce her. So today we have Yuan Yang, who is the Beijing tech correspondent for the FT.
Nice to be here, Joanna and Alice.
Yuan has also run sexual consent workshops for university students, and she covered Me Too recently in China on the internet and also its censorship. She is going to get deep with us today on this issue. So, Yuan, let me ask you about your recent coverage of the Me Too movement on the internet.
So I think one really good question to frame this with is, can we call the Me Too movement a real movement in China, given that the government has a history of cracking down on anything that looks like collective action coordinated across the country? And I think the internet has really changed things, obviously, in China. In January, within days of Luo Shixi's petition going up, there was a WeChat group set up of over 200 students from universities across China talking about similar cases that in their own universities, trying to brainstorm and plan how to bring Me Too forward on their own campuses. And I think that's what you can call the beginning of a movement. Of course, it's not a movement in the same way that you might conceive of in the UK or the US. There isn't a lot of funding. There aren't NGOs being set up. There aren't marches, demonstrations in public, by and large. But I think the energy and the momentum around it online is really palpable. It's something that's gotten everyone talking. And I think the fact that there have been linkages made between universities across the country, that to me is the start of the kind of network that makes a movement possible.
Right. So in your recent reporting or your viewing of these university students that you talk to for your reporting, because you concentrate on university students, what did they talk to you about in terms of Me Too or sexual consent?
So I've been present at some meetings of feminist groups discussing Me Too cases in their own universities. I've also heard students talk to me personally about their experiences. And I guess a couple of things really strike me. One is the assumptions. Of course, there are many assumptions around what constitutes sexual consent, and that's the case across the world, and that's often what leads to sexual assault or rape. And the second thing that really strikes me is the lack of knowledge around sexual health and contraception in China and how that really exacerbates sexual assault because of the many medical problems that it can then lead to. And just on the second point, right now, I think rather than using condoms or using proactive contraception, university students often feel they have no choice but to use the morning after pill or even abortion in the worst situation. And it's absolutely terrible that a friend of mine who is a university student told me that she saw an advert for an abortion clinic that had discounts for students.
Wow.
Which just shows you how much that's ingrained into people's expectations that it would be the women to clean up the mess if there is a pregnancy, and also the lack of understanding of preventative contraception. That's partly due to the lack of sexual health education throughout any level of the university system in China, and the fact that parents, as well as teachers, have a strong taboo against students getting into relationships at any stage of their education. It's seen as a distraction from their studying.
So Yan, you're saying that sexual assault can have pretty horrible consequences, particularly because there's a culture of not using contraception. So it's less likely, say, a young woman would be on the pill and she may get pregnant if she is assaulted.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And in fact, I think the pill is known among some female students in China, but other methods of contraception are really unknown, even beyond the pill. So for many women, the pill doesn't work for them. It has the wrong side effects for them. If you were in the UK, for example, on the national health system, your doctor would probably give you a lot of different options. Have you tried this or that? Have you tried the IUD? Have you tried other kinds of pills, etc.? And in China, that's really not discussed at all. It's either nothing, most usually, or the pill, or potentially condom use, or the morning after pill.
So when you talk to these university students and they tell you that they're relying on abortion, or not relying on abortion, but they're using the morning after pill, and later on we see the ads and we see the other things targeting students to get abortions or what have you, do you feel like they are aware that there are other options available?
No, really. I think it's generally a lack of awareness, because if you think about it, where would you get the information from? Your parents probably didn't tell you about it. You went through school with nobody around you knowing about forms of contraception. Your teachers never taught you about sexual health. And so by the time you're sexually active, of course, it's very natural that you would just assume that everybody like you is having either unprotected sex or only relying on one method of contraception, and that's the only way. So I think it's unsurprising that there is a low level of knowledge, and it's partly because of the taboo around sexual health and discussing sex at all in China.
So Yuan, let's talk about the Yuexin case, where a PKU student, Yuexin, tried to find out what happened to Gao Yan, another student from the 1990s, who had suffered sexual assault at the hands of an advisor. Do you want to give us some background on that?
Yeah, so I think what's interesting about this case is that Yuexin herself was trying to find out the facts from Peking University, one of the most prestigious universities in the whole of China, and asked them how did they deal with this case at the time, because actually Gao Yan committed suicide later, and many of her fellow students at the time blamed this on the university's handling of the case and the fact that she wasn't isolated from her professor, who she'd accused of sexually assaulting her. So a lot of attention was pinned on Peking University, even though this was a historic case. But as the Me Too movement flared up again, it brought such historic cases that others felt had not seen justice back to the fore. So Yuexin wrote to the university and asked them, what did you do? And according to her, she was continually harassed by university officers after doing so. And note that she herself wasn't asking for a specific outcome. She was merely asking for information. And this escalated to the extent where the university contacted her parents and told them to basically get her to quieten down. She was effectively taken into house arrest at her family home for that incident. This is actually quite a common pattern that on campuses, university administration want to keep anything quiet that could damage the reputation of the university. So presumably they saw this Yuexin's request, thought, oh no, this could lead to really bad press for us. We need to quiet this down. And then they go to the family of the student to try and get them to put pressure on the student, as well as going to local police and so on. So there's lots of pressure from multiple sides here.
Right. I remember reading about this and about how her mum, I think, got really, really upset because she'd been taken by PKU administrative staff and said, do you know what your daughter is doing? And do you know what's going on? And she's raising awareness of this particular issue and topic.
Yeah.
And it's really incredibly damaging to her school career and for somebody who had worked so hard to be at PKU, at Peking University, and then to raise these issues was basically damaging her school career. So part of it was her was sort of sexual assault and feminism was detrimental to her career, is how the school had framed it.
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to, I think, the concept of nao shar, or raising a fuss. I think this is one of the ways in which administration, people in power, will try to stop people from speaking out by saying, oh, you have so much to lose, you have this great career ahead of you, you have this degree that you're pursuing, why don't you just calm down and be quiet? And that's a huge disincentive for people to speak up, because they're worried about being remembered, you know, in the news or by people with power as the one who was trying to hold powerful people to account. And in this case, it's not even that Yuexin was finding justice for herself. It was a historic case. She was trying to uncover the real story behind it. And even that was enough to be deemed too sensitive by PKU.
Yeah, so this was exactly what happened also with the case I mentioned earlier on about the student in Qingdao suing the police, and the police brushing her off. She first tried to go to her university, but her university dismissed a case, and she said her professor let the male student who raped her go home, like kind of run home to get away from the situation.
Mm.
And after she spoke with me and other foreign media, she told me that the university talked to her parents multiple times and told her that she might not graduate from her degree if she keeps going on making a fuss like this. So sadly, it's so common. And also sadly, in June, like I think the whole world who was watching China was shocked and saddened. There was another suicide case.
Can I also just ask, Joanna, the Qingdao case you're talking about is the case where the woman had said that there was CCTV footage of her assault, but that the police, I think,
she
that's,
said
I think
the
that's
police
worth
didn't check
mentioning.
It.
Yeah. So in that Qingdao case as well, the role of the police was really contentious because according to the victim, she said that there was CCTV footage that she was assaulted in a common space in her school, and therefore there was a surveillance camera pointing at her and that there should be footage. But until now, she's not been able to recover the footage from the police. And I think the role of the police in dealing with these cases is also what partly ignites the imagination of Chinese social media users, because the lack of surveillance footage or claiming that there isn't surveillance footage when potentially there might be surveillance footage is a recurring theme. You had that last winter in the kindergarten scandal. You had that in many other scandals in China where suddenly valuable evidence just went missing.
So there have been so many cases, it seems like this year, that's hard to keep track for even us. From what we just discussed with the university students. And now in the summer, we have seen these reports of sexual assault allegations against leaders in the NGO field. For example, at the end of July, there has been an accusation against Lei Chuang, who is a leader in the vaccination movement. Have you heard about this one, Joanna?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite significant because as a journalist covering these issues, like I heard kind of whispers among some activists that male leaders of these activist groups sometimes disrespect women, but they don't want to make it public because activists are already in such a precarious position in China. But the fact that we see these cases coming out and NGO leaders are apologizing for what they did, it shows that people are also prioritizing their personal safety.
And Yuan?
I think that's a really important thing to emphasize, because I can understand the trade-off that you might think you have as an NGO member in China. There's been a series of laws in recent years cracking down on what NGOs can do and restricting your activities. So you don't want to raise any negative attention to your organization, but still you have to think, you know, what are you sacrificing here? Because if you can't have a safe working environment, you can't have a safe movement, then should we really have these leaders at the forefront? And I was very glad to hear that, you know, in the wake of the Lei Chuang allegations.
Do you want to recap the Lei Chuang? So Lei Chuang is somebody who's been working in the NGO field for a long time. And I actually read some a recap by Li Maizi, who is one of the Feminist Five. And one of the allegations in late July is that he has been sexually assaulting or raping the volunteers that are working with him on the hepatitis B vaccines.
So there's been at least 10 activists in Chinese NGOs who have been subject to several sexual misconduct allegations. And so it's definitely outside universities now. And just, you know, the last few days I saw news on my news feed and I was so shocked because I've been to this temple, the Longshan Temple in the Beijing mountains. And one of China's highest ranking Buddhist monks, Shi Xuecheng, he's being accused of sexually harassing nuns at the temple. So it seems all over Chinese society this is happening. What do you think about that, Yuan?
I think the fact that it's not just the university sphere, it's also NGOs, it's also the media. So several prominent columnists and also one of the most famous TV personalities, Zhu Jun, was accused of sexual assault last week. And now even the world of religious orders. I think this just shows that the common theme isn't, you know, what kind of industry you work in or your career background. Because, of course, in China, people associate, I think, the media industry and NGOs with loose standards of living. I think there's always been that tarnishing of you know, anybody who works in entertainment, oh, of course, there's a certain kind of woman, you know, lots of victim blaming there. But the fact that this isn't just restricted to one industry shows that it's not really about necessarily the inverted commas kind of person involved. It's about power differentials. The monk you were just referring to, Joanna, is still president of the Chinese Buddhist Association, who is the head abbot of his monastery, and he was abusing nuns who were under his management, allegedly. And in all these other cases, we see, for example, Zhu Junquai's, he is a very well-known television personality. He's been the host of the Spring Festival Gala, one of the most important TV events in the Chinese year, for the last 20 odd years. And it was an intern who alleged that he'd molested her while she was working with him. So in all these cases, we get these huge power dynamics that are exacerbated by a deference to authority and also a lack of police backing of the person who is the weaker person. And I think that's also what has led to so many Chinese social media users watching these cases, because they can in some ways sympathize with that, with the idea that the justice system in China privileges the powerful at the expense of the weak.
I feel like that too. I feel like in these cases, of the reason that we're not taking them seriously, or I guess the general public isn't taking it seriously, is because the men like Zhu Jun at CCTV, they can get away with anything. So even if an intern comes out and says, behind closed doors, he did this to me, most people will just sweep away the intern's explanation of what happened to her, even though it's obviously founded, in my opinion, because of what Yuan, you have just mentioned about the lack of judicial accountability, which is a huge problem. And I guess my take on the allegations in the arts also, I just want to mention, is that I just read this morning the very famous poet and writer Chun Shu has come out at the end of July saying that she was sexually assaulted, and I think not just sexually assaulted, raped actually, because one of her posts on Weibo, this is on the Chinese microblog Weibo, was against two people. One was Zhang Chi, who is a writer, and then the other is the founder of New Weekly, Sun Mian. And I think that in both of these cases, these tweets or whatever you want to microblog posts are still available, because I guess the arts is different because there's less censorship, because it's art, you know, like writers talking about other writers, or like, for example, New Weekly, the magazine in China, is government-backed in the sense that it has a publishing a serial number, and it has gone through the censorship process. It's in Chinese. So the founder of this magazine, it's quite a big magazine, sexually assaulting one of the most famous female writers in China, is a huge deal, and it's not been censored so far. But she came out and said when she was 23, she was sexually assaulted. She's in her 30s now. So I think in the arts also, this case in particular is huge. And these are repeat offenders as well, because other writers have come out and also said that I've also, you know, this has happened to me. So these women are sort of being believed because more women are coming out and saying it's happened to me, you know, in the same field by the same men in power. And they're also saying I was very young at the time, you know, I was in my 20s. I'm more powerful now, but I'm in my 20s at the time. And I think in Chun Shu's case, after, you know, a big banquet dinner, she was taken to the side of a room and assaulted, or she was taken to a hotel room and assaulted. So so now that they're older, they sort of have come out and say, you know, this is my story. And also when I've read commentary on this by Li Maizi or other Chinese feminists, they usually say it's good to speak out because it means that they don't feel like the victim anymore.
I think that snowballing effect of the Me Too movement in one allegation often turning up many more allegations because of repeat offenders, that snowball effect is really a big issue for censorship and how censors try to deal with the issue in China. Because on most issues, there's a kind of automatic censorship mechanism that if an issue is about public unhappiness over an event and it gets a certain level of kind of frequency of retweets and discussions on Weibo, then the authorities will automatically shut that down because they see it as an opportunity for mass unhappiness, mass unrest about some part of Chinese society. And that's automatically bad. But sometimes that it means putting a lid on a pressure cooker where the steam is just building out up.
Yeah.
And there's censorship that leads to even more unhappiness because people then start to blame the censors, saying, why are you shutting us down for this?
Right.
So I think that is the fundamental problem, this, you know, this terrible attempt to shut something down by repressing it, which obviously doesn't lead to anybody being happier for it.
Right.
Which is a dilemma that the censors are facing in, with the Me Too movement. How much space can you give people to vent and to collect testimony? And how much do you let people share information that fundamentally questions the basis of the Chinese criminal justice system, as well as Chinese institutions like universities, like CCTV, like state media, and so on?
Right. Yeah.
So I'm surprised that all these cases are coming out and being shared so widely. Like, I thought I heard that the hashtag MeToo and MeToo in China was being blocked on Weibo. Has it been unblocked, or are people finding ways around it to still talk about it yet?
There are lots of alternatives to the MeToo hashtag on Weibo. And also, Weibo blocking is very erratic. So I noticed, for example, a few days ago, I managed to post a link to an FT Chinese article about MeToo with the hashtag MeToo in English hashtag, and that was fine. I managed to post that. A couple of days later, that Weibo post just disappeared from my profile page, you know, which is this kind of quite sneaky backwards censorship where you don't know that your post has been deleted, but it has effectively been deleted. There are other ways in which Weibo can censor you but not tell you, so then it's makes it even harder to track the censorship. For example, what's called shadow banning, which is when the platform stops your tweet from spreading to other people, but you see it and so you think that it's been posted. So there are lots of examples of kind of roundabout censorship tricks. So yes, that's right, Joanna, the Me Too English hashtag has on and off been censored on Weibo, as well as the Chinese version of it, Me Too, which means rice bunny.
Yeah.
And people have found really funny ways around this. For example, I saw somebody trying to use the emoji for a bowl of rice and a rabbit instead of the Me Too hashtag. Also just translations of Me Too into other languages. And there was a great post, I think Luo Shishi shared it, which had a collection of different translations of the phrase Me Too, and then saying, you know, you think you can censor us all, but in fact, you know, this is where the linguists can step up to the plate.
Right. I just want to add to the Chen Shu allegations, because it's not just what I said about the New Weekly, it's also other big Chinese periodicals, and they're the people in charge who are usually men. So the other periodicals like China Weekly, Zhongguo Xinwen Zhoukan, and the others, there are lots of men there who are being accused by their writers or former writers who are women of sexual inappropriate behavior. And I think we should quickly touch on the gradations of the sexual inappropriate behavior, because Yuan is here and she has led consent workshops. Because, like, for example, writers are saying at this dinner, you know, this famous editor put his hand on my thigh and stroked it, and then afterwards he kept on chatting to me on Weixin and saying on WeChat and saying inappropriate words like flirtatious behavior, or, you know, carried on. So I want to ask Yuan, because you have experience, how do we define consent and the gradations of sexual assault?
Yeah, I think the gradations question is very difficult to answer, because each instance of assault happens within a certain context. So for example, Alicia mentioned the hand on your thigh, and you can imagine that can happen in a variety of different contexts. For example, a stranger on public transport, or it could be your boss, you know, in your office when you two are the only people in the office, or it could be a colleague at a work event, you know, at dinner. It could be somebody doing it to you while you're both visible to everyone else who can see that the person's doing this to you. And those contexts, and also your relationship with the person, the power involved, will hugely affect how much of a deal it is for you personally, and how much it affects your relationship with that person. So of course there's a in UK law there is gradation between sexual assault and rape, where rape is defined as sexual intercourse, actually in a very male specific way. So yeah, it's about kind of penis and vagina intercourse.
Okay.
Which completely rules out some forms of homosexual.
Yes, of course.
Rape and so on. Yeah. But in any case, in the UK law, that's how it's defined, as sexual intercourse without consent, or where consent doesn't exist and the perpetrator doesn't have a reasonable belief that consent exists either.
Yes.
So those are the three ingredients, the sex, the lack of consent, and the lack of reasonable belief in the consent.
Okay. And then what about...
Yeah, and also in China, it's interesting that the law... Like, first of all, like you mentioned, sexual harassment law is very thin. Like, there's not a lot for prosecutors to work on. On top of that, in Chinese law, like, men can't be rape victims. Mm-hmm. Only women can be raped. But men can be sexually assaulted. I think... Like, going broader now, this ties into what Alice and I were talking about, chatting with each other earlier about power and whether women can also be the aggressors. Because we've done some soul searching as well on things that we did in the past, like me pulling on men's belts at parties and kind of cackling like it's a joke. And then later feeling regretful and apologizing because I didn't get the consent of these men to grab their, you know, clothing. Like in China, like, are people talking about this? Are you talking about, it's such a traditional society where men are supposed to be like the people in power. Are there any cases involving gay men or men who might have been attacked by women?
I feel like gender gradations, like sexuality and homosexuality in China, especially amongst Chinese men, is such a, and this is me generalizing, but such a taboo topic that if a guy came onto another guy inappropriately sexually, that it wouldn't be necessarily talked about. What do you think, Yuan?
I think men in China have largely been absent from the mainstream conversation. That's not the case for conversations. I know that in many LGBT NGOs, men there have, you know, taken an active role in saying, especially after the Lei Chong allegations, and they've taken an active role in saying, this is not acceptable in our community, you know, standing up at conferences and saying, you know, these are the ground rules for consent in our community.
So I think, gay men or straight men?
I think, yeah, gay or queer men in the NGO world in China. So I think there have been, you know, men really stepping up to the task and of trying to maintain safe communities in the NGO world. But I think in the more, let's say, mainstream Chinese discourse, men are largely missing from it. There is always the assumption that men are the sexual drivers, are the active party in sex, and that women have to be persuaded or kind of mollycoddled and in some cases coerced into sex. And when I talk about this with Chinese friends, you know, around my age or slightly younger than me in their 20s, I'm always surprised at their relations of their first sexual experiences.
Why is that?
So many female students, as we mentioned earlier, don't have access to contraception or don't have the understanding of how to access contraception, which adds a certain complication into having comfortable sex, because then the woman is often worrying about getting pregnant, which is something that is less of a deal for the man. And that's led to female friends of mine talking about their first sexual encounters at university, of being one where they felt supremely uncomfortable, but they felt like it's something they had to do to keep the relationship going, or because it's something that their partner demanded, and because at the time that they thought that's kind of just how it happened.
So this would be interesting, ties back into the gradations of sexual assault in China, especially. So if a writer, like, you know, the one I mentioned before is Jiang Fangzhou, saying that an editor at one of these big magazines put his hand on her thigh and she doesn't, you know, she, and it's sexual assault, she's sort of defining sexual assault herself right there, right then, because in China, you know, the power dynamics are so that, like you've just said, men almost think that it's okay to physically be in close proximity with the women or even have their hands on them, and in a way that's, because sex is more coercive, right? The man takes more of the initiative in this society, in this patriarchal society.
Yeah, I would say there's a shade of that across the world.
Yeah, you know, of course. Yeah. So in this sort of gender dynamic here, in this country, it becomes very grey, I feel, much more greyer than it would be in the UK.
Yeah, and when we talk about gradations in the law as well, the Chinese law is extremely vague about this. It's not very analytical. So the Chinese law will refer to phrases like the use of force, the use of violence, and these concepts kind of presuppose other concepts such as consent and what is normal. So if you can't have a standard for what is, you know, consensual sex, then how can you start to talk about forceful sex or violent sex?
Right.
And it does conjure up this image, which is actually the minority of cases of somebody doing physical harm to you in the act of raping you, which is actually not that common. A lot of the time, the victim has no physical damage.
Yeah.
And that is because they're being raped by somebody that they feel they can't say no to, they can't struggle against because of the power dynamic.
Right, because we've all had stories of these in Chinese families where the husband is sort of publicly beating his wife and then you don't really know what to do because you want to raise it to the police.
Yeah.
But and it's, they don't want to do anything.
Yeah, and that public kind of, that domestic violence in public is almost... in some places accepted by the police. I remember another NGO training on domestic violence, a woman giving a great tip actually for all the participants. A lot of time, if you're a witness to domestic violence in public, you might want to call the police and say, look, there's a man beating his wife. And this woman was recommending that rather than saying it's a man beating his wife, you just say, look, I'm on the street. There's one person beating another person.
Nice.
And that often yields a much stronger response from the police, who take it more seriously.
I mean, not nice for the woman being beaten up.
But as a tip. And then there are lots of these really great kind of what are called active bystander things that you can do. But just knowing how to frame it in a way that makes more sense in a Chinese context is helpful.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
So, Yuan, like, where do you see the Me Too movement going in China? Because we do still see ongoing censorship, even like you said, it's kind of on and off and erratic. And the government must be nervous because there's already been sex scandals affecting top politicians, like pretty senior politicians, who were accused of and prosecuted for having seen sex workers and giving their mistresses a lot of money, for example.
And if we scroll back a couple of years, remember that the booksellers, the Hong Kong booksellers who were illegally extradited or rather kidnapped, taken to the mainland and had show trials for selling books in Hong Kong. One of the books that they were selling was actually an account that alleged that President Xi Jinping was on the verge of divorcing his current wife before he became president. So, I mean, that just highlights how sensitive personal stories are for the leadership. There's no way in which the leadership would want anybody to get their hands on that material, because it's not that it's necessarily politically relevant, because it's about the love life of a leader, but it does lead to mockery. And that's something that an authoritarian government cannot stand, is any kind of mockery or joke making, laughing, ridiculing.
I feel like Me Too isn't gonna... almost like Me Too isn't going to affect them, because everything that comes out about anyone in the leadership or anyone in any leadership will just be swept aside.
Mm. I think there's a danger of severe repercussions for the individuals.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
To go back to the Zhu Jun case, the CCTV case, that stands for the Chinese State Media Channel. So he's probably the most high-profile establishment figure who's been implicated in this, along with, of course, the president of the Chinese Buddhist Association, the abbot that we just talked about. And that allegation was censored really quickly against Zhu Jun. But what's worth noting is that the woman who made that allegation, according to her, when she reported it to police, a policewoman told her, this person has a tremendous positive impact on our society. So why are you taking this forward? Why don't you just drop this? And that just shows how much the Chinese police and the judicial system can back the powerful against the weak, which is, of course, a really major theme and ignites a lot of anger among Chinese internet users. I think to your question of where can this go, even at the brief meetings I've been at of feminists and others discussing Me Too in China, I see a lot of pent up energy and anger in the room, and women coming forth with even more of their own personal allegations that they're not yet sharing in public. It strikes me that there's a lot of fuel, you know, left to burn, and it's going to take quite a long time for it to all come out into the open. I think the Ministry of Education has taken some active response in acknowledging that universities do need to change the way they handle sexual assault. So hopefully what we're going to see is that universities will start to implement policies dealing with sexual assault and harassment, start to learn from international examples and start to reform their procedures internally. But it's going to take a long time for other parts of Chinese society to reform and to kind of change institutionally too.
Yeah, let's hope that this the recent Me Too movement that has sprung up because I think we've decided it is a movement, is going to head into new and interesting and really positive direction.
Yeah, I think in a way, like, it's depressing seeing all these cases, but to me, it's also been, like, I've covered human rights for so many years, and it's always been so depressing, but there's really been such, like, a groundswell of advocacy and story sharing I'm seeing in China, especially among young people and university students. So it kind of gives some hope that society will be more open. And I haven't, like, you know, all over the world there's so much misogyny and woman bashing and victim blaming, but at least in China, as far as these university students, there hasn't been as much of that. I've seen more of a majority of people supporting these women when they come out, rather than asking what they were wearing or if they were wearing
a skirt really good.
And things like
that. I feel the same way that there's a new generation of women who are becoming feminists. So I think that we've actually seen this amazing positive outcome because I think more younger Chinese people are interested in NGO work and in feminism work. And a lot of these kids, I think, are like born in the 90s, and they're sort of very, very active and engaged on social media and off social media. And I think it sort of fills me with hope and excitement in a way, you know, that's not just drudgery about what Joanna was saying, just lots of negative reporting. So what do you think about that, Yuan?
Yeah, I think that there is obviously a lot of censorship on the Chinese internet, and, you know, there are tens, hundreds of thousands of censors full-time employed to do this. But there are infinitely more inventive things that people have done to get around censorship. Private channels of communication can be really explosive in getting a story out, and stories like Me Too tend to snowball because they lead to more allegations, they lead to more people identifying with the story. I'm reminded of one of the students I spoke to from Tsinghua University, again, one of the top universities in China, who was actually part of a support group on a labor rights dispute, so not part of the Me Too movement. And I asked him, you know, do you think this movement that you're part of, which is looking at labor rights, is going to grow? And he said yes, because now it's just so easy to share information from across the country of where these protests are happening. So I'm still very, you know, optimistic about that snowball effect. And despite censorship, the Chinese people are infinitely more inventive than the censors.
Great. That sounds like a really good positive direction that we're heading in. Now we're going to have recommendations, but unlike the Seneca recommendations, we're going to focus on self-care and living well. So, Joanna, what recommendation do you have?
Yeah, sure. Well, it seems hokey, but there's a lot of meditation apps available, and I'm always like laughing at my friends who kind of were like, oh, I'm going to go and stop and meditate. But then they actually show me like a 7-minute guided meditation. And then afterwards, I'm like, yeah, I'm like amazing. Like things as simple as like, oh, name 5 things you can see around you, or name 5 things you can hear. And then it kind of really makes you present. So I think that really helps with the really juggling and busy work that we all do as writers and artists and translators.
So you recommend which app?
I tried one called Calm. It's on iPhone or I think Android as well.
Okay, you can just download it. And
yeah,
then
it's free.
There's free guided meditations. Cool. I also think that's a great recommendation. Yuan?
So it's funny, we've been talking about the transformative effect of social media in China, but I would actually say a huge recommendation from me is to actually maybe not be on social media as much, especially when it comes to having, you know, random, often in my experience, guys who I don't know, you know, at you and then curse at you or just call you names. I imagine that many other, you know, young Chinese or Chinese diaspora women attract this kind of attention on social media.
Yeah,
I think sometimes it's helpful to ask yourself when you're reading those messages, like, why would somebody talk to me in this tone? You know, it's not even necessarily the content of the message itself, it's the tone that is really striking.
What's the tone?
Just aggressive, you know, presumption that they know you in some way, that they have the right to say these things to you. And maybe I often imagine myself in dialogue with these people, and they've kind of come at me with a lot of aggression, and my response to them, you know, in my imagined, this is obviously an imagined kind of scenario, is to say, like, why do you want to talk to me like this? Mm. You know, you don't know me, why would you want to talk to me like this? It's like a, you know, random stranger coming up to you on the street and starting to start an argument. You might want to get into that argument, and sadly, sometimes I do get into that argument, but almost kind of more important than the content of the argument is.
And this is on Twitter or Weibo or Weixin?
A little bit of Weibo, mostly on Twitter.
Okay.
Including from, I've noticed more and more Chinese language interaction on Twitter.
Okay, so, yeah. So Chinese followers.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, I wrote about the, you know, the Wu Mao, the 5 cent brigade and the modern version of that early this year for the FT, basically writing about how there's a wave of young nationalists on Chinese social media, but also increasingly going out onto the blocked parts of foreign social media, so Twitter, Facebook, trying to make their imprint there. And sometimes I suspect that the responses I get are from, you know, that category of people who don't really want to engage. They just want to make their anger felt.
Mm, and they shouldn't be directing it at you, though. Or at, because you say it's sort of across intersectional sort of Chinese descent women and then like Chinese users who are in writing to you in Chinese, assuming things about you that they don't know.
Yeah. I think there's also sometimes a presumption that if you're of Chinese descent and you're writing about China, then you should be patriotic and should be glad for your motherland and so on. And that's the kind of tone I sometimes get.
Yeah, patronizing. Yeah. Right.
I wonder if you get that more because you keep your Chinese name in English.
I don't know. I mean,
people talk to me more like, oh, you're a foreigner. You're a foreign Chinese.
Yeah, no, I
what
mean.
What do you know? They don't say things like you're betraying. It's like, oh, you're a foreigner. You're not, you're overseas Chinese rather than.
Yeah, I think on social media, we all have headshots, right? And I think in person, we might have more conversations about our real stories and our histories and so on. But on social media, people just react to what they think you are. Often I get a lot of really funny assumptions. So I'm British, in case you can't tell from this podcast. And people like on Twitter will assume that I'm American. They'll be like, why are you defending America?
Why would they assume you're American? You don't seem American.
I think because there are lots more East Asians in the US than there are in the UK. Okay. It's just like much more common to find. So,
and you're from Yorkshire, right?
I am from Yorkshire. Which no, nobody's ever attacked me England. For not defending Yorkshire sufficiently on Twitter.
You don't sound too much like you're from Yorkshire.
Sadly, I've not been there for a long time.
Okay, but, that makes sense. You know. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of rare to have two UK Chinese people on the podcast. So I'm glad that we're both here. Me and Yuan. Yay, UK Chinese. But in my case, I guess also Chinese, because I was identify as both.
Mm-hmm.
So you identify as UK Chinese, right?
I think I would tell people I'm British Chinese.
Okay.
Yeah, or Chinese British. And it's always fun to swap around which adjective comes first.
To see the reaction. Hong Kong Canadian.
So I don't identify with mainland Chinese at all because Hong Kong such a particular culture.
So you're Hong Kong Canadian.
And I was born in.
Yes, let's do a separate It's great. I love the fact that we have these like interesting identities and we can talk about so much. Separate podcast. So my recommendation is to go visit some of the Buddhist sites in China. Because we touched on the Longquan Temple, where the abbot, or I guess the head monk, has been accused of sexually assaulting his nuns. But I do feel like these temples themselves, like, if you want to go to Longquan Temple, you can go. But the ones in Beijing, I'd recommend a specific one is the White Cloud Pagoda. It's in Beijing, just to go visit on the weekend for self-care, because this one's also actually recommended to me by Ian Johnson, the writer, because when you actually go, there's actually a sense of tranquility and peace if you don't look for the religiosity. So like, you know, don't look for the monks and the nuns and the actual religious ritual practices. Maybe I can be corrected on this by Ian or by somebody. But generally speaking, I go to these places because I actually feel like they're pretty tranquil and you can just walk around, admire the architecture, go in and see the Buddhist statues. If you want to light incense, you can. But mostly it's just about walking and taking time for yourself in a quiet place that is sort of designed for devotion, even though the actual Chinese Buddhist Association practices and what have you can be off-putting. I.e. the Me Too movement, you know, the fact that it's sort of incredibly administrative and it's not, you know, it's its own separate system, how the abbots and the nuns and the monks, how they're trained, and if they're actually religious in the first place, we have really no idea. But the actual temples themselves were built for religious reasons, and they were built for devotional reasons centuries ago. So that would be my recommendation. And I now pass this to you guys, if you have anything to add.
Yeah, that was great. And thank you, Yuan, for coming and
thanks for having me on the show.
And thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, guys. We have a new charter that's on our website. Please go check it out. It's about people that we work with and also ourselves and what we tolerate and do not tolerate in terms of sexual harassment and other forms of abuse. And please watch this space and get in touch with us if you have any questions or comments. The New Voices podcast is part of the Syndicate Network and powered by SubChina. This episode was recorded by Anthony Tell and engineered and edited by Kaiser Core. Our theme music is by Wu Fei. Our website is nuvoices.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at nvvoices. Contact us on our website and leave a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening and spread the word. Solidarity.